On today's episode of The Good Word, Jake Fisher joins the show to recap the games from the weekend. The Suns have a new head coach, who's an old head coach. And we talk the NBA draft and Bronny James with Kristen Peek. All that and much more on today's episode of The Good Word.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. It is Monday, which means that actually doesn't mean anything because we got Jake Fisher, of course, who's in Chicago for the NBA Draft Combine. We've also got Kristen Peek, who's going to give us a little preview into the first four picks and some of the biggest storylines coming out of the NBA draft lottery day yesterday. Jake was actually in the room during the actual draft lottery. We'll get into that in a little bit. But first, Jake, I want to start off with Frank Vogel out, Coach Bud in Phoenix. Is that just rearranging the deck chairs of the Titanic? Like, I'm not sure how much better if Mike Budenholzer is a better coach than Frank Vogel. Both of them are championship coaches. Maybe Bud is a better offensive mind. Like, how do you see that, considering that came together really, really quickly in Phoenix?
Well, it came together really, really quickly after they waited a week and a half to, you know, quote unquote, make the decision, which, you know, the proverbial knowledge of this space is that you don't necessarily fire the coach until you know what coach you have lined up, although the Los Angeles Lakers don't seem to be in that position. So I'll give the Suns some type of credit, I guess, for going through a 10-second search. I don't know. No, but to answer your question, on a, like, X's and O's schematic championship pedigree standpoint, is Mike Budenholzer a much better answer for the situation than Frank Vogel? No. The one big difference is that Bud has had, at least he's been given credit for a little bit more offensive creativity, which is, I think, largely what the biggest detractors of Frank Vogel's year in Phoenix were harping on, including players in that locker room. But that last piece is the biggest part of this. If you spoke to anyone around the people who are going to be still on that roster, a trainer, a college coach of theirs, an agent, like just anyone in that periphery, to a man, no one thought that Frank Vogel could come back and command the respect of this locker room. And it sounds cliche to say that, you know, he lost the guys, but if that's a real thing, like, this situation seemed as close to losing a locker room as possible. The rolling of the eyes was like such a common, I think, intel piece that so many people have said over the last couple months. I just think even though he had $21 million left on his deal, there just seemed to be like a little bit of a too far gone-ness to that interpersonal dynamic. And I think that is the real reason why. I don't think it's the fact that he didn't have the chops on a whiteboard or to come up with some scheme or whatnot. I think it's really about, do Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Bradley Beal, and whichever of these minimum players are going to pick up the player option that they were all given when Phoenix raced out of the gates of free agency and gave those two-year minimum deals with a player option that was inventive to some degree. I don't think those guys really wanted Frank Vogel back.
Look, when the players decide that they're done with you, then the organization is done with you. And whatever reasons that may be, you look at KD, this is going to be, since Steve Kerr, I feel like I can name the coaches like off the top of my head, right? You feel like you can name Kenny Atkinson, then Steve Nash, then Jock Vaughn, then Monty Williams, now Frank Vogel and Mike Budenholzer. That's like six coaches in, what, 5 years or 4 years or whatever it is, including the year where he didn't even play basketball because he was out with an Achilles. I don't know if that's bad luck for him, or no situation has been optimal for him. I just think he's a fascinating ball player to look at, especially as he's coming down the back end of his 30s. I don't know if he knows what he wants, because I'm sure if Kevin Durant still wanted you know, Frank Vogel to be there, Frank Vogel would have been there. That's not to say that everything is on Kevin Durant, but that's on Kevin Durant. It's on Devin Booker. It's on Bradley Beal. Like, all three of those guys. I just don't know if any coach can be there and maximize what those guys have in Phoenix. I just think it's a poorly built roster.
There's also these interesting dynamics at play where, of course, Bud was the coach against Phoenix in the 2021 NBA Finals, who beat them. But I don't think at the time there was a ton, especially when Phoenix went up 2-0, I don't think there was a ton of, oh, this guy across the sideline is this wizard that is beating us. I don't think Phoenix came away from that series super in love with Mike Budenholzer. And last year, after he got fired in Milwaukee, and it's, I mean, almost a year to the week here. Like I remember being in the lobby of the Marriott here in Chicago, and John Horst walked through day and night with a phone glued to his ear and a hat pulled down low over his eyes because he was trying to find the next head coach for Giannis Antetokounmpo and the Milwaukee Bucks. And that was the talk of the week here. And Mike Budenholzer did not really get involved in the Sun search a year ago, by all accounts. I think he had preliminary conversations, but that job came down to Frank Vogel, Doc Rivers, and Kevin Young, to my recollection. I mean, it's come up in conversations the last couple of weeks that, like, Bud was not, even though he's an Arizona native and that's a nice homecoming story, like, I don't think Bud was the guy for this team by any stretch last year. So to turn around a year later and all of a sudden he's the answer is definitely an interesting cherry on top of all this Sunday. You know, maybe it's some whipped cream on something else. But I don't know, man. I think ultimately the biggest hurdle for Phoenix to overcome is really not the guy on the sideline. They need to figure out ways to flush out the rest of this roster behind that quote-unquote big three. There's people around the team who are optimistic that Bradley Beal, after this being his first healthy offseason in 4 years, will come back stronger and blah, blah, blah. But, like, you watch Derek Jones for Dallas, Nicholas Batum for Philly, I mean, even Russell Westbrook to a certain extent with the Clippers. Like, the Suns need to get one of these minimum dudes to pop. Like, they need to find someone at, like, the bargain bin of free agency to come in there and really move this thing forward. I will be curious, depending on what happened in Golden State, if there's a potential for a Chris Paul reunion after he got essentially run out of town. But if they're doing mea culpas about a $50 million head coach, maybe they'd be happy to revisit a veteran minimum for a guy who's definitely not having his $30 million contract picked up in Golden State unless it's being used as a trade asset. So that's just something that I've been told to monitor. But I think that's a bigger point of, like, this team has way more to resolve than just the white guy holding the clipboard on the sidelines.
Yeah, it's a lot. They got a lot going on there. But I feel like we should transition now to teams who are actually playing.
Let's
teams who have really good presence and some teams who have really good futures. And I am in Minnesota, where I feel like I'm at the marquee series, even though that series could very well be over.
It's tied
2-2. The Nuggets and the Timberwolves.
There's one guy on this call who got to go to the marquee series.
Is that some hateration and holleration? Is that what I'm sensing there, Jake?
No, it's okay. You deserve it. I'm having a good week.
Exactly.
Good to be here in Chicago.
You're in Chicago hobnobbing. Come on, man. Like, yes, I'm in Minneapolis. Timberwolves, Nuggets. The road team has won every game. I think yesterday was probably the most compelling game, 115-107. There was that, of course, 20-second stretch where the Nuggets literally scored 8 points, including the buzzer beater from Jamal Murray from like 50 feet. From afar, Jake, did it look like Anthony Edwards is like, oh, okay, I'm ready for this, but my teammates aren't? Because that's what it felt like inside the building.
On TV, it did, especially, I forget exactly at what point of what his scoring total was, but if I remember correctly, at one point he had 43, and the TNT broadcast flashes, you know, the little push-out box from the little square in the bottom right corner, and it said 43 on 16 of 24 shooting, which pretty hard to be more efficient than that, man. And we were talking about it before we went live. Like, it's such a silly little thing, but that clip of Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns slipping and sliding into each other, it kind of felt like a microcosm.
Looked like a cartoon, man. Looked like a cartoon.
Especially two big guys. I mean, I wrote about it on Saturday in Dallas. Like, almost as funny as Chet Holmgren chasing Derek Lively around the court with his arms outstretched. Just when two big guys do something goofy, the surface area for goofiness only grows. And it was, to bring it to basketball, like we've said it on No Cap Room, I think it was pretty evident in all of our predictions that we wrote in our roundtables, like, the champs are the champs for a reason. And Jamal Murray was not going to have as bad of a performance as he did in game two continually. People already on Chicago, like, I only got here yesterday. The weekend's kind of been full of G League Elite Camp and stuff like that, but a lot of the league is here. I'd say there's been some whispers about maybe the league did the Nuggets a favor not suspending him, and like, what kind of precedent that sets. Because, like, if you're a referee now, players can just hurl objects at you and then they can pay their way out of it. That's an interesting precedent to set for all that type of stuff. But, like, do you want a repeat of Amari Stoudemire not being able to play for the Phoenix Suns way back when? Do you want to take away, like, the true optimal form of what this postseason matchup should be? I don't necessarily fault the league for doing that. It's just a thing to note. I think the biggest thing that stood out to me about Minnesota not being, like, ready for the moment, to your point, was just that, like, Denver's taken punches before and overcome it, and that's one thing Minnesota hasn't. You go back to that Grizzlies series when they overcame the play-in tournament and Pat Bev was twirling his jersey on the stands and whatnot. Like, they were up 2-1, was it, on Memphis? Or they had a chance to go up 2-1, and they just never recovered, and their recovery was going out and trading for Rudy Gobert. Like, Denver's Michael Malone, said this, I believe, after game three, like, going back to the bubble, Denver's come back from 3-1 multiple times. I just think that, like, resolve is something that the Nuggets have in their DNA. That maybe it's not even, like, a detriment to Minnesota, just they haven't been together long enough to have those types of experiences in their back pocket to lean on.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Like, I don't view the bubble in the same way. I view it as an accomplishment. But when I think about 3-1, I think about the travel back and forth. You know what I mean? Like, in the bubble, you're in the same place, the same environment. It doesn't take away from the accomplishment at all. It's just a completely different environment than the normal gate of the NBA playoffs. Yeah. But
raise you, and I know I keep interrupting you on your show.
No, go ahead.
I'll just raise you then. They're up 2-0 on Phoenix last year, second round. They go back to Phoenix, lose two in a row, and then they just turn around and blow the doors off of the Suns and start this whole Monty Williams, what's happening in Phoenix. You know, the Nuggets are kind of as responsible for that as anybody. So,
well, it's crazy, and it's not even a counter to that, but that was just Phoenix hitting crazy shots for two games. And I think that Denver knew that that wasn't sustainable. Denver, the one thing about Denver that everybody seems to say, Anthony Edwards has said it, Mike Conley has said it, Chris Finch has said it, they are not going to beat themselves. And that sounds like such a simple statement, but you have to actually go out there and beat them. And that's what Minnesota did in the first two games. I don't know if Denver was going to be beaten these last two games on the road. Like, they played with such a serious approach. They played with, like, a tightness. They played with a focus that Minnesota doesn't have the experience of going through yet. Like, we don't know if we can trust Karl Towns. Karl Towns had a miserable game, right? Miserable game. It was Mother's Day. We all know that he lost his mother, Jacqueline, in the early days of COVID in 2020. Like, really sad story. So you can understand that his focus, his mind could have been elsewhere. He struggled in the series to begin with, no matter what the circumstances were. So it's hard to contextualize game four within, you know, the first three games or so. And I looked at Jamal Murray looking spry. I looked off the bench. I'm like, wait, Justin Holiday is contributing? Christian Brown is out there doing it, hitting open shots. Michael Porter Jr. didn't do a lot yesterday, but Aaron Gordon did. Aaron Gordon hit his first 11. And that's a guy that sacrificed, you know, even though I think he's in the perfect role, you know what I mean? And you wrote a really interesting story about the bromance between Aaron Gordon and Nikola Jokic.
Thank you.
Just the fact that he has embraced playing next to him and embraced that he can be the best version of himself, you know, submerging himself into being the best complement for Nikola Jokic. I think that was, you know, like that takes a lot of awareness for a guy like that. For Minnesota, they don't have that guy yet that realizes that Anthony Edwards is the franchise. I need to make myself the best complement, the best thing for him, as opposed to the best thing for me. And I think that's where the Minnesota Timberwolves are. And I think Ant is a little ahead of schedule. I think the Timberwolves are not. I don't know if they expected to be this good this quick, but he's better than the team is, if that makes sense. He's further ahead at 22 years old than where the team is. And now you have to look at the Nikhil Alexander Walkers and the Jaden McDaniels. Like, those were the guys who were really getting after him in the first two games. And those dudes disappeared at the crib. But that's what happens.
One thing on Justin Holiday. So when I was following the Nuggets for that story on AG and Jokic, that was like mid-March. And someone around the team said to me, like, I know we're grooming Peyton Watson to kind of play some postseason hero type spots like Christian Brown did a year ago for us, but the coaching staff likes Justin Holiday and be prepared for him to be involved. And I looked at the numbers and I remember when we put together seven under the radar X factor players for at the start of the playoffs, I put Justin Holiday in there because he was the sixth most efficient player on the team. And on based off of Impredictables overall, like net rating numbers and box score plus minus stuff. And he's a career 40% 3-point shooter. He's super lanky. Like, I just kind of had an educated inkling that he was going to be called upon and could maybe deliver. And shout out to Justin Holiday. Like, definitely the most afterthought of the three Holiday brothers, and he's the oldest. Both Drew and Aaron were first-round picks. Aaron's had a little bit less of a decorated career, more of a journeyman like Justin. But that guy's bounced around the league, man, and he has kind of slid into the Jeff Green spot of that rotation. Even though Uncle Jeff was more of like a backup center for Denver throughout that playoff run, but Justin's the like veteran guy pushing 35. Is out there and is kind of playing for his last real shot of glory. So, and he's delivering. Shout out Justin Holiday.
Yeah, I've had Justin Holiday when he was a vet in Chicago, still, you know, figuring out, like you said, in the journeyman status, but he was just a professional that everybody liked. And he would go in and he would play defense and he would hit shots. Those are elements that sort of fit well on any type of championship team. For sure. Now, two teams that ain't winning the championship this year. And they're tied 2-2. The New York Knicks and Indiana Pacers, I got a hot take for you, Jake. The Pacers are winning that series, okay? Because the Knicks are running out of bodies. They're just running out of healthy bodies. Like, if you look at it, the Knicks won two games under sort of nebulous circumstances in New York. And, you know, I just think it's not that the Knicks aren't a better team. So I think they are a better team if they are whole. But they're not whole. They're not going to be whole. And Jalen Brunson can only handle so much. Josh Hart can only play so much. I just feel like they're just running out of bodies. They've played too many minutes. And at some point, like, the magic pixie dust is going to wear off. Maybe the magic of Madison Square Garden is going to help. But there's not a lot to talk about in that game. But I just don't know how the Knicks can keep playing the guys that they're playing. Like, you run out of good players playing heavy minutes.
I agree. And the fact that they did not get game three in a super emotional, like, knockdown, drag it out kind of closing stretch there, Jalen Brunson had to be answering those questions about that last shot on the right wing. I mean, clearly was trying to get fouled. I've been watching that guy up close and personal enough this season to know when Jalen Brunson's trying to get fouled. And he was trying to get fouled. And he clearly had a moment of self-reflection when Fred Katz, friend of the show, asked him about that. Sorry, I was trying to look up their record with and without OG Anunoby. I could not find it in time for this point. But that is, I think, the clearest thing here. You can withstand the losses of Julius Randle and Mitchell Robinson only so much when you don't have your 6'8", 240-pound wing who can guard 1-5. And right. I think that's the biggest thing here. When they didn't get game 3 and it took so much out of them just to be in that position to have Jalen Brunson flinging that prayer, hoping for a whistle, I really did not think they had enough left in the tank to turn around and make game 4 much of a fight. People, you know, walking into these arenas, covering these games like you've been doing, it's a little bit funny to me how people every game, pregame, were like, what do you think is going to happen tonight? Because I don't know. You don't know. The players don't know. But right. That's the business that we're in. But I had a pretty good feeling that the Knicks were going to kind of lay an egg based off of the fact that TJ McConnell is morphing into a prophet sent from Hickory High. And that, I mean, Obi Toppin can't miss from three.
No, what we're not going to do, he is a great athlete. That is what we're going to say about TJ McConnell. We're going to say it about Peyton Pritchard. They are great athletes. They are not tryhards. We are not going to put that label on them about, oh my God, they've been so overlooked. And look at the grit and toughness. No, we're going to reverse. We're going to reverse the racial coding of all this. Okay, Jake? We're going to say that these are exceptional athletes. They're not well coached. They didn't come from great coaching families. These guys are exceptional, gifted athletes sent down from upon the heavens. Sorry about that. Go ahead and continue.
No, TJ's been awesome. He deserves every second of shine. The fact that that dude still wakes up and looks himself in the mirror as a 10-year NBA pro and says, I gotta do what I can to prove that I deserve to be in this league, is an awesome mentality, I think, for anyone to have about just like their own paths and their dreams and chasing what they want to do. But the fact he's morphed into this scorer over the last couple of weeks, ever since Benedict Mathurin went out for the year, has been amazing to watch. And when like Aaron Nesmith is hitting threes and Obi Toppin's hitting threes and you go down the list and everyone's hitting threes, like I don't really think New York is going to have too much of a chance without OG Anunoby. To your point, like, do they just switch at home and they get some Madison Square Garden magic and they squeak out another one? I think it's super possible. To me, I would be far more surprised if the Knicks just laid down and lost 4 straight after going up 2-0 compared to the Minnesota conversation we were just having, partially because they're not playing the defending champs and they're playing a young upstart team that has shown their own proclivity at times to just kind of let go of the rope and run around with their heads cut off a little bit, pushing the pace a little bit too fast and flying a little too close to the sun type stuff for Indiana. I think we kind of saw that against the Lakers in the in-season tournament when we were there in Las Vegas, where like they were being anointed and just they didn't have it one game. It was only one game. But I think when they don't have it, you can really tell pretty early that they just like don't have that fifth gear that they typically have an advantage on other teams on. So we'll see when that switches back. But to me, it is all about the health. And I don't want to like pat myself on the back for talking about it last week on No Cap Room, but I just think it was obvious to anyone who's been following the series. Like we've been talking about this since the end of game 2, where they didn't make it out with a healthy OG Anunoby and a healthy Jalen Brunson. Jalen's saying he's fine. But like, he's come out of multiple games now in these playoffs with lower body injuries that are taking your toll. I mean, Luka Doncic keeps saying he's fine too. Well, he's saying he's battling, but if you're out there, like, there's a difference between being hurt and being injured, and all these guys are hurting right now. So, yeah, I think the injury parts are definitely adding up for New York, and I am weary for them that even if they get past Indiana, just like we said last week, that they're going to have anything close to enough to get to Boston. To your point about the whole beginning of this, neither of these teams are winning the title.
Yeah, neither one of these teams. Like, I mean, like, Knicks fans got a little pissy with me last week because I said Jalen Brunson's numbers are better than he is. As in me saying he's not a 35-point scorer on an absolute heater right now. Like, that's not who he is. He's on a run. This ain't what he's going to be for the rest of his career or the rest of this series. Like, that would make him the greatest player of all time, which he is not. Calm down, Knicks fans. Y'all will survive. All right?
He is great, though.
Now, Jake, you were... No, he's really, really good. Now, Jake, you were in Dallas for Game 3 of Mavericks Thunder, a series that, if I'm to pat myself on the back, and much to the delight of producer John, I picked the Dallas Mavericks to win this series because I felt like the Dallas Mavericks had to win this series. Like, they're the most determined team in this, where we keep telling the Oklahoma City Thunder, you're going to get there, you're going to get there, you're going to be here for the next 4 or 5 years or whatever it is. Like, it's hard not to let that stuff, you know, seep into your head. And if P.J. Washington scores 26 points, that's going to be really, really hard to beat, in addition to Luka and Kyrie being really, you know, really good closers. Like, do you see that series sort of playing out as far as experience and desperation? Does Oklahoma City just have to go through what maybe Minnesota went through last year, what Minnesota is going through to a second degree this year?
Yeah, being on the ground for that series, there's definitely an air around the Mavericks of, we have two all-star guards either in their, like, tail end of their prime or really right in the beginning of it, and there's no time to waste. That's why we traded two first-round picks to go get Daniel Gafford and P.J. Washington, and we had this rookie in Derek Lively the second, who everyone is singing his praises as he's started the year and as he's really settled in nicely as a backup, although he has had, I think, a very up-and-down series against OKC, where at the start, at one point through Game 3, that was the last game I went to, and they play Game 4 tonight after we record this, that he started the series 2 of 13 from the field, and a lot of them are just like floaters, and Luka even came out, I think it was after Game 1, and said that we need our bigs when they roll to like jump off 2 feet and then basically like stop being soft and go up there and dunk that thing on people's heads. And there was one play in Game 3 where Lively did that, and Luka just fist pumped like he had watched his little in the fraternity like take a keg stand for the first time. Like, that's the worst analogy I've ever given in my life. But Luka's a drinker,
Are you a frat boy, Jake?
No, definitely not. I was in a fraternity, but I did it for not that reason. That was more of an allusion to Luka's party habits than myself.
Gotcha. Wait, is your twin in a fraternity?
My twin was in a sorority.
Oh, so you have a twin sister. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
KP has a twin, the identical twin. You have the fraternal twin. My bad. Sorry about that.
It's okay. No, I think...
It's a lot of twins at Yahoo Sports. I ain't one of them. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard. It's hard to get you all from one thing to the side. My fault.
No, you're good. To bring it back to task, I think OKC clearly has an athleticism disadvantage and a size disadvantage where it's just obvious on the glass, and it's obvious when the Mavericks are getting stops and they're getting out in transition, which was even more obvious when OKC was doing the intentional hacka on Derek.
Yep.
Because, and Kidd said this post game, the Mavs got to set their defense. And every time they did that on those, not every time, but the first two times for sure, and I don't remember exactly off the top of mind, it was a couple of days ago on a flight and times, not a time zone change, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Definitely the first two times that they went to the hacka strategy, the Mavs got to set their defense and they got OKC turnovers and they ran out in transition and that was that. So I just think overall too, and shout out to the Mavericks PR team for giving me one of those nice row 3 behind the scores table seats for Game 3 at the AAC. It was also like we're accustomed to seeing Luka Doncic complaining to the refs. Jason Kidd post game said, yeah, he's consistent, kind of like a wink and a nod at one inconsistency from the officials.
Right.
The battle between him and Lu Dort is absolutely brutal to watch. But I'll tell you, man, these young Thunder, from like Case and Wallace up to Shea, and Shea's obviously been in the playoffs before this whole era started with the CP3 Dennis Schroeder teams that went down to the bubble. And I think he probably, you know, was positioned for that dating back to like being part of that 8 seed type stuff with the Clippers.
Right.
These Jalen Williams, like Jalen Williams with a Y, not J Dog, J Dub, like everyone on this Thunder team, Isaiah Joe, second round pick who got waived in Philly. These guys are all walking up to the refs and complaining every single play. It's the first time I've been that close for a playoff game, so maybe this happens all the time. But it was really distracting, and honestly, I like lost a lot of the like young Thunder. You guys are fun, man. I hope to see what this turns into, because like it seemed like maybe they were in a bit over their heads of like the playoff warfare of it all. Like I generally think that across the board, the officiating has become too much of a talking point in the general NBA discourse this playoffs. It happens every spring. Right. It happens every spring. And I've played my part in it in writing an article about coaches' challenges. Don't get me wrong. But to me, that's like a data point and something that is a tool in these coaches' toolkits. And like, it's part of the game. The like incessant complaining. And these guys are putting their hands on the refs every time. They're like grabbing the refs' shirts to show where they're getting grabbed, and to a point that it's just kind of, I don't know if that was like game three showed the Thunder losing grips of things, because they were right there at the thick of it at the end. Chet was incredible defensively, but it just seems like from like that warfare standpoint and like this chess match standpoint of, we're going up against Luka and Kyrie. They've got everyone's running behind them. The Thunder aren't afraid, but they don't seem like they're in, they're at an altitude that they haven't really cruised at before. And it seems a little turbulent so far.
Yeah, it's just a natural thing in playoff basketball. Like they can still be fun and all those other things, but you feel the expectations of being the number one seed. You know what I mean? Like you feel those things like better than, even though they won the tiebreaker between, you know, Minnesota, Denver and all that stuff. But like you feel the expectation, like Shea was an MVP candidate. You know what I mean? Everybody's saying all the great things about Chet Holmgren. We've said things about Lu Dort and Jalen Williams. Like you know that as much as they want to say that they're going to be there for the next 4 or 5 years, this is their first time going through it right now. And you still want to win. You just don't know how to win, and you're there against a veteran team. It just makes for a really interesting dynamic between like desperation and inexperience. Maybe not desperation on Dallas's part, but they just recognize that there's an opportunity in front of them. Speaking of recognizing an opportunity that's in front of them, I present to you the Boston Celtics. Like they do what they do. They blow a game at home because they just don't take shit seriously. And then they go on the road against the Cleveland Cavaliers team and they decide to take the game seriously. They take a 2-1 lead. The details of the game only matter but so much. But Jason Tatum finally had a game. Like, that was the thing that got me. Jason Tatum had a game.
And he got to the rim.
The thing about that to me, Jake, is he's not super athlete. So I don't expect him to do what Anthony Edwards does, to just blow by a guy, blow by the second defender, and meet somebody else at the rim. That's never going to be Jason Tatum's game. Like, he's 6'10", so he's going to use length and skill and all that stuff. And when he tries to go into those other bags, that's where he gets himself in trouble. But is Boston, in your mind, with everything that you've seen in the playoffs so far, are they still the favorite that they were overall going into the playoffs? Or are you a little alarmed by having not seen maybe the most serious approach game in and game out?
I think they're doing what they've done all regular season. Like, they're going to drop an egg. They're going to. That's just kind of – they don't have what Denver has, to your point earlier, of like they're not going to beat themselves. The Celtics will beat themselves. Not often. Jason Tatum said it after game two. We went on a kind of long monologue about how the Celtics don't necessarily get the credit for being a super team because, like, every time they lose, the sky is falling. But they pretty typically respond after that loss. And they did. I think the fact that someone with Cleveland was texting me saying, man, we just need to get Dean Wade back, that didn't work out so well, buddy. Jared Allen not playing
That's the problem.
A huge problem. And I would have a better like confidence in my answer to your question if we had that litmus test to score what Boston's doing. Because as it stands right now, your boy Evan Mobley is still not ready to be the single front court member of a postseason rotation. He's just not. He's 21, 22. Like, I'm not faulting him for being, but it's much harder of a, I mean, I see it with Chet Holmgren, where there are certain plays where that dude is flying out of nowhere with a vicious, vicious block, but then he gets his legs taken out under him and he's on the ground because he's a toothpick.
Right.
Like, it's much easier for an Anthony Edwards at 22 to fill out his 6'5" frame and figure out how to move in that body at this speed, at this level of physicality, than someone who's 7'1" and gangly and still maybe even growing at a certain extent when he first entered the NBA. But they don't have enough, I think, as presently constructed to really give Boston that issue to really see like what they're made of. And I think with the Pacers-Knicks side of it all, like I was really rooting to see a as healthy as possible New York team against Boston. I really wanted to see Boston go up against the team that I saw playing against Philadelphia in the first round. If we're not going to get that, I don't think Boston's going to have much resistance until they get to the finals, which that's a whole nother conversation of,
right.
Sure, they'll have won three series to get there, but if Denver had to claw back against a really tough Minnesota team, and then they're going to have to beat a pretty good team that comes out of this OKC-Dallas matchup, which right now I feel like any of the four teams in the West have passed to making it. Like, you can't say that about the East, and I do wonder if that's setting up Boston for a potential letdown come finals time, or are they going to be, like, saving body blows that these other teams are you know, having to suffer through to get there? I don't know. We'll have to find out.
I think it's a weird thing. I think Boston sits in such an interesting spot because we've seen them in different iterations and we assume that every team is the same team. And this isn't the team that went to the finals in 22. This isn't the team that kind of melted down even last year in a game seven or in the Eastern Conference finals altogether. They melted down in game seven because they had nothing left after that, you know, 3-0 comeback against the Miami Heat. But Kristaps Porzingis is on the mend. Like, the longer you can go without needing to press that button and getting him back on the floor, the better it is for them. Like, the most rest that they can get, that's better for him. Cleveland being without Jared Allen really hurts. Like, if there's one example, there's one sort of advantage that they have, it would be in the size department, because Darius Garland, Donovan Mitchell, smallish. You know what I mean? Donovan Mitchell is broad across the shoulders. Like, you ain't going to bully Donovan Mitchell. But Darius Garland is slightly built. Like, it's just a weird, it's a weirdly built dynamic of a team, but they've gotten here. And Donovan Mitchell had a great game two and had a great game three, except in game three, it didn't matter. And I heard your point about Evan Mobley. If you want to sell your Evan Mobley stock, sell it to me. I will hold on to it. I will keep it there. He is still Slim Duncan more than he is Tim Duncan, and that's fine. I will allow him a couple of more years to go into his body, to not be light in the pants. That's fine. All right, cool.
Yeah.
Darius Garland hasn't been good either.
To your point about Ant and the Wolves not being ready, if he's not ready for Donovan, that's a problem for Cleveland overall. Like, their window is very, very important right now. They need to win behind Donovan Mitchell to make sure that he wants to stick around long term. And if Evan's not ready for that task, which he was in game two, but on a consistency standpoint, that's an issue for Cleveland's like overall state of the organization.
Yeah, it's just they're on two different timelines. Like, the organization itself is on two different timelines. Like, they finally won a playoff series with Donovan Mitchell. I think that was critically important. But when you have guys like Garland and Mobley, who are on the younger side of things and are still growing and trying to mature into their bodies and mature into their games, it just makes for a weird dynamic. But I understand why Cleveland made the move, because I do not believe in just sitting idle and just, you know, saying, hey, young guys, I'll leave you to your own devices, Detroit Pistons. Now, that, ladies and gentlemen, is Jake Fisher. Thanks, Jake, for joining us. Don't forget, Jake is the host of No Cap Room. So Jake will also be doing that later this week. Jake, thanks again, man. Really appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
We're going to pay some bills and come back with Kristen Peek and talk about the draft combine and a sneak peek at the draft order right here on The Good Word. And we're back with Kristen Peek. KP, this is your time of year. The draft is upon us. The draft order was established yesterday. Thank goodness I was not there, or else the pitchforks would have been out from Detroit Pistons fans who would have called me a jinx. We'll get to that later. But the first four picks were announced, rather, the order. The Hawks, the Wizards, the Rockets, and the Spurs at four. KP, let's start with number one. Is this an Alex Saar draft for everybody, or is this just the guy that's going to be picked number one?
I don't know if this is an anybody draft. It was so weird being in the room. I wasn't in the actual lottery room, but where the broadcast was taking place. And I've been the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, last year, the energy, you could feel it. You could feel the energy. This year, I mean, the Hawks win the lottery pick for the first time in franchise history. They're going to have the number one pick for the first time since 1975. And no one really seemed to care. And so when you say, yes, this is an Alex Saar draft, he probably is the best prospect at number one. You are sandwiched in between a Victor Wembanyama draft and a Cooper Flagg draft next year that's coming up. So there wasn't that necessarily like tanking excitement that we felt last year. I don't think it's going to be the same next year. We did it at 2 p.m. on a Sunday during Mother's Day instead of prime time on a Tuesday at 7 p.m. And so there was just a lot of different varieties. But yeah, I mean, if I'm the Atlanta Hawks and I decide to keep that pick at number one, I'm probably taking Alex Saar.
I mean, the crazy thing, KP, is that everybody's talking about bad draft. Let's get out of the first four picks. Okay, that's cool. You got to find somebody to take those picks because they know the same things you do, which brings us to the Washington Wizards. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, Washington Wizards, they had success drafting Bilal Coulibaly last year, you know, the 6'8 defensive wing who played with Victor Wembanyama in France. And this year, sitting at two, the second best prospect, I think, in the draft is another French wing, Zachary Richichet. And there is not like Washington Wizards fans are like, we don't want him. We don't want him. Why don't you want him? He's shooting 40%. He's 6'8, 6'9, one of the best defensive wings in France right now. His task is guarding the best player on opposing teams, players that are sometimes twice his age. Why wouldn't you want that? I don't understand this notion with teams and fans saying, oh, we already have that. Look what OKC did. The way they decided to rebuild is they went out and they got Shea, they drafted Josh Giddey, and then they got a ton of 6'7 plus wing players, playmakers, defensive versatility guys to kind of slide in alongside them. So you never know which way they're going to go. It's very unpredictable. So I don't mind Richichet at number two, but I know Wizard fans are too hyped about it.
Look, trusting Washington Wizards fans, like, what do they know about what's good for them? You know what I mean? They've never seen good basketball for as long as that team's name has been the Washington Wizards, okay? like they were going to move to Virginia a couple weeks ago. So I'm not really, shall we say, bullish on the former Bullets fans. All right. Now, can I say the name Zachary Richichet 5 times fast? No, because I barely just said it one time. Did I get it right?
You did. Yeah. I'm sure he'll come over here and we've all been saying it wrong the entire year, but that's how I know to say it.
Okay, cool. So now we might get an American-born player at number three with the Houston Rockets. And you've been taking a little bit of flack from the Rockets fans for your projections here. So I will give you the floor to defend yourself.
At number three, I have Donovan Clinton, the 7'2" center out of UConn, who when 100% healthy is the defensive anchor for the 2-time defending UConn Huskies. So at number three, I'm looking at what has Houston invested in the last few drafts. Amen Thompson last year, Jalen Green, Jabari Smith. Yes, at number three, I've seen other people, other names shoot up like Modest Buzelis, the 6'8 G League Ignite, maybe Ron Holland, another 6'8, 6'9 versatile wing. But if you are going to be successful in the Western Conference, what we're seeing Minnesota do, where they have 2 7-foot-plus bigs to try to slow down Nikola Jokic and the Denver Nuggets, I think this is a fine pick. And you know exactly what you're getting, especially in a draft that's all over the place. Donovan Clinton, after Alex Saar, is the defensive anchor that any franchise would want, with the way he can defend and also his footwork. Like, he moves a lot better than you think for someone 7'2", a lot better than Zach Edey, like we saw in the championship game. And he has a little bit of mobility to his pick and pop and room to develop. He's only a sophomore. He's very young. I wouldn't mind slipping him in the front court alongside Alpi. So I don't know, like, who do you want, Rockets fans? What who do you want at 3? You don't want someone to come in and anchor your defense and be able to compete in the Western Conference. You want Reed Shepard. You want another guard. You want Ron Holland, who needs the ball in his hands to be effective. I think it's a fine pick and something that they're going to consider.
Well, I mean, look, the fact that KP, we thought Ron Holland might have been the number one pick, and he's nowhere near the top four, just shows how topsy-turvy, you know, the top four picks are. But I feel like I've seen a run of Nikolas. For a while, we had a run on Jalen's, right? Now we got a run on Nikolas that brings us to the San Antonio Spurs.
San Antonio Spurs, honestly, like, I think, you know, they won the big draft last year. I think they were big winners in this draft because it gives them a little wiggle room with 2 lottery picks, first picking at number 4 and then again at number 8. And if they decide to keep the picks, what they need more than anything is playmaking. And Nikola Topic, he's like a Serbian Josh Giddey. He's 6'6". He's still playing. He got called up to the EuroLeague and, you know, is playing very effective, very well. One of the best passers, averaging nearly 5 assists per game, you know, for his Serbian team. And so at 4, I think he's a great option there. A lot of people also like Rob Dillingham, the 6'1" point guard who came off the bench from Kentucky, who's just super shifty. And, you know, you see Dilly and Wimby kind of teaming up, but I think he could be there at 8. So if you are the Spurs and you want to roll the dice and try to get a playmaker, why not take both of them? Why not take whoever you prefer at number 4? And then at number 8, if you want a wing, you know, I saw someone say, oh, Julian Champagne is right now our small forward that we have. Well, then are you not going to try to make it work with Wimby? I would take both of them. I would take Topic at 4 and Dillingham at 8 if he's there, or Reed Shepard or another playmaker, just to try to get him as many touches on offense as possible.
Before we move on, KP, and for those who don't know, Kristen Peek will have her own podcast, On the Clock with Kristen Peek, coming up very soon. When you're on this podcast, the name for Victor Wembanyama is Big Slim. That is what we call him on this podcast, Big Slim. Now, we can go to 5, 6, 7, and 8, and if you just want to have whichever one of those picks actually intrigues you, Detroit at 5, Charlotte at 6, Portland at 7, San Antonio again at 8. Do any of those spots intrigue you, or should we just move on to the big questions of the draft?
We just move on from the big questions. I think Modest Muzelis has really helped himself. He looks physically stronger. He's someone that could sneak up into the top 3. I have him going 5 to Detroit. You know, he doesn't have the outside shooting that I think they wanted in Richesse, so... But he's also a good option and has a ton of upside. We can go on to bigger questions now.
We got bigger questions, right? So, Bronny James, and you hit us like 10 minutes before we were supposed to come on and be like, we have to talk about Bronny James now, because the NBA's Fitness to Play panel has cleared Bronny to be drafted and to play in the league. We know he had the cardiac arrest thing at USC last summer, a really scary situation. An underwhelming freshman year at USC. He entered himself into the draft consideration and the transfer portal at the same time. How do you see his future in, or at least just in the draft? How do you see him playing out?
I think he's going to get drafted. I think he stays in this draft. I know there's a lot of buzz around Bronny James coming into Chicago. A lot of NBA execs and a lot of scouts want to see how he does in NBA rules and spacing at the 5-on-5 scrimmages Tuesday and Wednesday here at the Combine. And by all accounts, he's been looking great in pre-draft workouts, working out alongside Rob Dillingham and also KJ Simpson, the CU point guard, who is one of the toughest guards in the Pac-12 this year. So I think he's going to do enough this week in Chicago to get himself drafted. I think he might even leave with a promise, or at least, you know, different teams that want to bring him in individually for workouts. It'll be interesting to see if he opts in or out for his media availability. He's only spoken to the media three times in his high school and his 1 year college career. I was there for all three times. That's how long I've been covering Bronny James. And so, he's definitely the most intriguing player at this draft. When you're looking at the Lakers with the 55th pick in the second round, that's the most popular landing spot, just with his dad being there and kind of fulfilling that destiny of becoming that first father-son duo to play in the NBA. So he's definitely going to be a player to watch. And, everything kicks off today.
Now, I'm very curious about the whole Bronny not talking to the media thing. Do you think he would be comfortable in a media setting? Because at the combine, it's like meat market. You know what I mean? It is, you're sitting at a table, everybody's in front of you. Like, for that to be your first real interaction with media, whether, you know, it's in a controlled environment or not, like, that can be pretty damn scary. So do you think he'll even opt into the media stuff?
I was talking to a team and they said, oh no, he'll absolutely do media availability. I'm like, you know nothing about Bronny James if you think this is going to be the first iteration of his media availability in a scrum setting. Like you said, last year we saw Brandon Miller get in trouble. There was a reporter that was asking him hard-hitting questions about his incident off the court. And, you know, the NBA is there. It's your media availability. You opted in for it. You have to sit there for the full 10 minutes, you know? And so I was thinking the same thing. I said, of all the times he could have had these reps in high school, in college, getting used to these sort of scenarios, and you're going to throw him into the NBA draft combine as his first, where you have NBA reporters, you've got draft reporters, you've got, you know, local reporters, you've got everyone is going to be there if he opts in. But I think there was a change in the media availability, which makes me think that he might be doing it, because instead of doing it at the arena right outside, where that's where they'd usually take the players straight from the court, bring them to media availability, they've now switched it to the hotel. And it's a designated time. So I saw that and I thought, okay, there is a chance now that they could try to control it a little bit better and make it more press conference style.
I wish I was there. I just wish in general, just to see like the spectacle of it. But at the end of the day, we are talking about a guy who is a second round draft pick. He just has a famous name and there's a lot of intrigue behind it because of his dad, because of the Lakers, because of all the other things. Let's get to some of the big basketball questions. Atlanta has never had the number one pick in the lottery era. I think it's been 54 years or something like that since they've had the number one pick overall in the NBA draft. Will they package either A, the number one pick, or B, the number one pick, and or Trae Young and DeJounte Murray to chase some type of star?
Yes, I think they're going to look at all options. Like I said, I mean, if you are looking at drafting someone like Alex Starr, who could hit, he could be another iteration that we've seen of Chet Holmgren and Victor Wembanyama, but he could also be Scala Bussier. You know what I mean? So there's
a haven't lot heard of that name in a long time. Good grief. Poor Scott. But he's drafted by Sacramento, right?
Yes. Yeah. But and Scal, look, he was at one point the number one recruit coming out of high school. So there was a lot of buzz coming out, but he just didn't translate to the NBA. Right. So having that kind of floor to ceiling and you don't know what you're getting and you're taking a huge risk, of course, the Hawks are going to look to try to package that and either, you know, trade Trae Young. I think I saw people were speculating that maybe the Spurs would be interested. And then that way, the Hawks could trade down to 4 and 8 and get more room there and maybe package the number one pick with Trae Young. I don't know if that would be enough, but that was just something that I was seeing, especially in this draft where a lot of conversations are going to be made, I think, towards the top, because nobody wants to be the person picking at the top. They want to see how everything else falls, and then they just take the next available. So they keep their job. It's job security time.
Well, the team I'm going to ask you about, nobody has any job security. In fact, there's job openings in Detroit. I might apply for president of basketball operations because I feel like I could do a better job than anybody they've had in the past decade. All right, look, nobody in the NBA draft, I'm going to say this before I go to the Pistons. Anyone who's had the worst record in the last 6 years has not gotten the number one pick. The Pistons are a special case, KP. because they've had the worst record, I think the last 3 years, and they've fallen out of the top four all 3 years. Can you say that this would dissuade teams from tanking, even with the, you know, flattened lottery odds that I've already basically told? Basically, Adam Silver has said, we don't like this tanking stuff. Do you think that it will dissuade teams further because you've seen this franchise have a string of bad luck?
I don't think so. I don't think tanking is going to end anytime soon, especially next year when we're looking at three players potentially that could be franchise players, and Cooper Flagg, Ace Bailey, who's heading to Rutgers, and also another French point guard coming up. And there's something coming that I've now coined the term Wimby wave. You know, it's not stopping with Alex Sarr and Zachary Richichet and Tijon Salon in this draft class. Next year, we're going to see Nolan Traore, who was by far the best guard at Nike Hoop Summit last year, that could be a potential top three pick in next year's draft. So there's still lots of options next year for teams to be enticed to tank or put themselves in favorable situations to land those three players.
KP, you said French point guard, and I immediately thought of Killian Hayes. I'm sorry, I just got PTSD.
He's way better than Killian Hayes, I promise you. I promise you.
Is it hard to be that much better than Killian Hayes?
Stop.
I'm sorry. PTSD kicking in. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the great Kristen Peek. She is live in Chicago for the draft combine. She was there for also the draft lottery. Thanks to Jake Fisher and KP for joining us today. Listen on Thursday for No Cap Room and on Friday On the Clock with Kristen Peek right here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Thanks to producer John and the entire team who works hard behind the scenes. I'll be back on Wednesday for another episode of The Good Word from Denver. Until then, everybody be safe.